Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Why is college so expensive, and is the cost always worth it? Ron Lieber joins us to talk about his new book, The Price You Pay for College. What should we know about our lungs in a time of viral pandemic? Michael J. Stephen will tell us about his book, Breathtaking, The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, our critics will join us for the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from The New York Times. It's January 29th. I'm Pamela Paul. My colleague Ron Lieber joins us now. He is a personal finance columnist for The Times, and his latest book is called The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Ron, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I had trouble reading that subtitle because I am one of those families, and the idea of this biggest financial decision that I will ever make, this is a big subject.
Well, I mean, why not call it what it is, right? I mean, it looms incredibly large, not just because the list prices are so high, but also because of the emotional component of the decision, right? These are our children that we've invested a lot in, both financially and emotionally, and we're about to send them off into the world. And the enormity is not to be underestimated, especially emotionally.
But is the enormity we sort of put on the idea of college, are we misplacing our priorities when we think that college sort of is equated with our children's future?
I think it depends on who you are and how much privilege you're coming to the table with. You know, if you're me and you're a New York Times columnist and you went to a selective school and you are reasonably well networked, there's a pretty good chance that your kid is going to be okay no matter what. And no matter how you define okay, whether it's income or friendship or connections or happiness in the world. But if you are starting from someplace else, right? If you are from a low-income background, if you are a person of color, the school can make a sizable difference in your trajectory. So it does depend on who you are, but I also understand why families who are more privileged than average get all caught up in the frenzy, because it literally surrounds us in our communities, in the media, and certainly in the high schools.
You bring up an interesting point, too, about what the intended, not just where you come from, but what your purpose is, what your intention is with regard to college. I mean, some people see college as primarily a financial decision, the sort of means to getting a job or a career or even just getting by. Others see college, and perhaps this is the person of privilege viewpoint, as just a fundamental part of being an educated human being. Other people see it as a way to compensate for what they think was a shoddy secondary school education, just kind of becoming reasonably well educated. And then others, of course, just see it as like a fun way to spend 4 years. Should the way that you view college and its purpose influence how you view that investment?
Yes. And you hit each of the big three. So I spent years asking people, what is college, right? Because you have to define that for yourself before you can go shopping for it. And so there really are three components, right? People shop for an education, right? They want their kids' minds grown and minds blown. Number two, they go shopping for kinship, right? You're trying to find your people, the people who will come to your wedding, the people who will carry your casket, the people who will hire you. And also, your mentors, right? The grown-ups who will influence you. And then the last part is the credential. And people think about that in a couple different ways. Some people come to college because they are looking for, you know, the basic degree that will allow them to grab hold of the middle class and hang on for dear life, right? So maybe they're coming from a low-income background. They want to become a teacher. They want to become an accountant. They want to become a nurse, you know, relatively recession-proof jobs. And then there are people who are reaching for the sort of gold nameplate. They want doors open to them that might not be otherwise. And if they're already from a privileged background, if they're already part of a fancy alumni network, they don't want their children to, you know, downgrade in, you know, access or privileges. And so they strive for it.
All right. For people who are not conversant in the three numbers 529 and sort of busily worrying about this, let's just give a sense of what does college cost? What is the cost in America of an average public school education and an average private school education right now?
Well, from the perspective of parents, we often confuse price with cost, right? So there's the net price. Or I'm sorry, there's the list price, right? So the list price at the most expensive private colleges and universities right now is over $300,000 for 4 years. And that's after taxes, by the way, right?
Does that include like food and textbooks?
That's everything, all in, yeah. At flagship state universities, you may pay more than $100,000 for 4 years. And that's if you can get through in 4 years, and plenty of people cannot. But the net price is something different. What's going on behind the scenes now is that there is not just the financial aid system of old, where discounts were based on what you earned and what you had, right? So-called need-based aid. There's also an entirely new parallel track of financial aid known as merit aid, where people are given discounts for all sorts of reasons. Maybe because you're a good student or a good leader, or maybe it's because the institution is in a market segment where it just no longer has much pricing power. Maybe because everybody around it is discounting, or because parents who have the ability to pay are no longer willing to pay for that particular institution. So it's kind of unpredictable.
Okay, this kind of thing makes me think of an area that you covered many, many years ago in your financial reporting, which was airlines and mileage. That, like, you know, my question is has college become kind of like buying an airplane ticket, where sort of the price that you're offered and the price you end up paying depends on all kinds of behind the scenes factors that you might not be aware of? In other words, is it different for everyone?
It can be different for everyone. I think there are a lot of similarities, right? If you ask a bunch of students in Bio 101 what they paid, there's a pretty good chance that you'll find in a class of 100, you know, 50, 60, 70 different answers. And then, you know, a whole bunch of people who just paid the full price. On the airline, there's probably slightly fewer prices in the airplane cabin, but it's not that far apart. The difference here is that the problem, the challenge, right? The extremely frustrating thing about college is that you do not know what the price will be until after you run the gauntlet and get your offer of admission.
It's like taking your car in for a repair.
Yeah. Or if you, you know, chose an airline, you know, on the basis of what you thought was its service or, you know, the food, you know, and coach or the legroom, right? And you had kind of a rough sense of what it might cost, but they didn't really inform you until, you know, after you got to the airport and there were only two airlines there waiting for you instead of the nine that you thought you were choosing from, right? So it's even messier.
Earlier, you said, you know, assuming 4 years of college, which is, of course, is the average, you know, the sort of standard time for a bachelor's degree. And then some people don't end up completing their degree. Others don't end up completing it in time. And there used to be the joke, you know, sort of the 5-year plan. But at that cost, it's not really a joke to continue to stay on to college.
It's not a joke at all. And, you know, for parents who are concerned about this, they should ask at every institution they are shopping for, not just applying to, but shopping for, you know, how long does it take the average student to get through? And if your child is interested in a particular course of study, that major, that department, that division of the university might have its own completion rate, its own 4-year completion rate that may be very different, right? So you want to ask those questions and ask how much more it might cost. And don't forget, right, if you spend 5 years at school, that's 1 year that you are not in the workforce. So unless you make that up on the back end before you retire, that's a year of earnings down the drain as well.
Okay, some listeners are probably sitting here and wondering how we are possibly talking about anything else after we mentioned that $300,000 figure. Because I think particularly for people who live outside the United States, that figure is just jaw-dropping and incomprehensible that higher education in this country isn't in some way underwritten by the government. Why are we so different from everywhere else?
Well, I mean, let's put that number in context, first of all. You know, it's, you know, just under 90% of undergraduates are getting some kind of a discount somehow. Now, when you look at the, you know, 50 to 100 most selective colleges and universities in the country, there's much more of a chance that, you know, 50 or 60% of the people there, particularly at the most selective institutions, are in fact paying full price. So it's a relatively small group, but there's probably a higher percentage of them among, say, you know, readers of the New York Times and listeners of New York Times podcasts than there are in the general population. So there is, you know, outsized interest in it. So why did that happen? How did this happen? Well, you know, I think the thing about the kind of red-blooded capitalist underpinnings of anything and everything involved in America is that there is always a temptation to see kind of how high is up. And it turns out, you know, through this experiment over just a generation or two, as these schools have become more and more expensive, both at the list price and slightly less so at the net price, we're realizing that parents are actually willing to spend a whole lot of money on their children. No big surprise, right? And if they don't have the money in the bank, if they can't earn it, they're willing to borrow as well.
All right. So most parents can't earn it. But of course, there are lots and lots of wealthy people in this country who can. I'm going to put those people to the side for now and talk about the vast rest of us. What does paying for college mean for most families? Because the kind of anecdotal thing that you hear among young people when they're contemplating family size is like, I could never afford, you know, college for more than two kids or more than one kid. And it might seem crazy to make a decision about how many children you have based on something that's going to happen 18 years after they're born.
I don't think it's unreasonable at all to do financial planning and projections before having kids and, you know, make decisions about family size on the basis of what it is you might need to earn or borrow, particularly if you are in a career that is not particularly highly compensated. But I don't want to scare the world into lowering birth rates in America, right? So let's think about it in like a way that, you know, where if you break it down, it isn't quite so scary. This comes from a financial planner in Wisconsin named Kevin McKinley. And he just thinks of it in chunks, right? Think about it in chunks of three, right? Imagine a kid who wants to go to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and that will cost, you know, roughly $100,000 all in if you are from the state for the 4 years. So you save a third of it, maybe $150 a month for 18 years until the child's ready to go to college. You spend one third of it out of current income. So that's, you know, roughly $8,000 a year. So with that $8,000, you know, you basically need $800 or $900 a month after taxes. So you eat some rice and beans, you cancel a vacation, and, you know, hopefully you're there if your income manages to stay stable and you don't have other unexpected costs. And then you borrow a third, right? $33,000 split in two between the parent and the kid, or the kid can borrow $33,000. And also, let's not forget the kid can work during college. The kid can, well, you know, work full time in the summer, right? So you start to move the numbers around and move the pieces. And it doesn't seem completely insane for one or even two kids for, you know, even for families at the bottom of the upper middle class.
All right. I know you don't want to scare anyone, but I am going to ask another kind of larger, scary question. You mentioned privilege right off the bat. And the big question is, does the cost of college in this country perpetuate economic and social inequality?
Does the cost perpetuate inequality, or do the colleges perpetuate it? You know, there's a couple different ways to think about that, right?
You can answer both.
Right. So yes. Much depends on the type of institution and its commitments, right? So an institution that is rich enough to accept all comers, regardless of their ability to pay, and does so for a proportion of each class that is at least parallel to what the larger country looks like in its demographics, is probably doing its job. And you can count those schools that do it that way on the number of fingers and toes that you have on your body. The rest of them are having more trouble. Now, that's, you know, one way to think about it, looking at kind of the most selective schools. But you could also look at the the least selective schools. You could look at the, you know, incredible community college system in the state of California that sends so many people on to, you know, University of California schools. You can look at, you know, the community college in Miami-Dade County that is, I think, the largest one in the United States right now and so successful that it just added its own bachelor's degree program. You can look at branches of state universities that help kids who commute and, you know, maybe 75% of the people at those schools qualify for Pell Grants because they have such low income. So, you know, there's extraordinary work being done among less selective schools, and there's also extraordinary generosity among the most selective schools. You know, in some ways, it's the schools in the middle that struggle most to get the equity right because they don't have a lot of money, and it's hard to help large numbers of people when you still have to pay your faculty and your administrators and keep the lights on.
You mentioned taking on debt, taking out loans as part of the way to save for college, both on the part of parents and on the part of children. So, Ron, you and I are not children. We are in our 40s. And I imagine that you, like me, know many people in their 40s who still have not paid off their student debt. How much student debt does the average American college student graduate with today?
It's just a tad under $30,000 a year. And, you know, much depends on your family background and the kind of school that you go to. You know, the thing about that, right, is that if you do, in fact, graduate, there's a pretty good chance that you will be well employed for most of your career. And you should not have trouble making those debt and making those debt payments if you are careful. The trouble comes from people who get the debt but don't finish, right? So they don't get the benefit of the income boost that comes from the degree. So from a policy perspective, you know, those are the people we really should be focused on the most. Then there are the crazy stories you hear about of people with $500,000 and $600,000 and $700,000 in debt. You know, a lot of those folks are dentists, veterinarians, doctors, you know, some lawyers get that high. And, you know, when they get in trouble, it's, you know, when they can't find a job or decide they don't like the career that they chose after all. So I worry a little bit less about those folks, even though they have, you know, really high numbers racked up.
All right. So since we're talking about policy, there was a proposal among some in the Democratic Party that the new administration offer a $50,000 student debt forgiveness, I think. And I believe the Biden administration has proposed something along the lines of $10,000. What should people make of this? I mean, if you were in charge with a magic wand, what do you think the government should be doing with regard to student debt forgiveness?
Well, I think the way to think about this, you know, as a interested or disinterested individual, but somebody who's curious, is to think about the politics, unfortunately, and less about the policy, because it's the politics that are clearly dictating what's going to happen here. It does not look like President Biden is going to sign an executive order to cancel a bunch of student loan debt. He's going to ask Congress to do it. And he did not ask Congress to make it part of the $1.9 trillion, you know, stimulus that the Democratic Party has proposed, right? So, you know, that suggests that whatever it is that's going to happen probably isn't going to happen for a while. Now, the politics of this are complicated with a 50-50 Senate and a close to 50-50 split in the House that makes the Democrats vulnerable to political problems 2 years from now. What they wish to avoid is some sort of uprising or upset from a whole not small collection of voters in America who did not go to college, who are not going to go to college, and whose kids may not go to college, who want to know why all of these fancy college people are getting free stuff now. That is a political landmine, and the Biden administration does not wish to step on it.
All right. I want to talk about fancy college people for a minute and also about everyone. You have a section in your book about, quote unquote, unhelpful feelings parents have, which is a very nice, gentle phrase. And two of those are fear and guilt, which I think seem easily understandable. But the third one is the pull of snobbery and elitism. Now, elite has become a kind of dirty word, but at its core, it means the best. And a lot of people, parents and kids, might say, well, what's wrong with wanting the best? Why shouldn't I want to go to the absolute best school that I can get into?
Oh, I don't know if I have a problem with that necessarily, but I, you know, I would encourage people to ask, right? Like, well, the best for whom, right? What sort of school is in fact going to be best for my child, right? Because if you think that, you know, the Ivy League or you know, Stanford and MIT are sort of the gold standard in this country, there are just a ton of truly miserable undergraduates at those institutions. And, you know, if you shop carefully, you'll discover that some of them mint happier undergraduates than others, right? And so the question is, what kind of kid do you have? Now, then the parents have to, you know, look deep inside themselves and ask themselves, okay, am I worried that, you know, I'm trying to save face here by making sure my kid can go to the alma mater or someplace better? Am I looking for a gold star parenting win when we do the sweatshirt reveal on Instagram?
Oh, do people do that?
Oh my gosh. Oh. You need to pay more attention to Facebook and Instagram on early decision day, you know, December 10th each year.
Oh my God. From gender reveal to college sweatshirt reveal. Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You know, and then there's the concern about other people's snobbery. The fact that it is still true that some of the most elite, you know, places of employment for 22-year-olds, the powers that be look askance at all but the 10 or 15 most selective or prestigious institutions as they define them in the United States.
All right. We are speaking, obviously, during a time of pandemic, which has radically transformed what college looks like right now. And there are many, many complaints people have about the experience. But one of the complaints that you hear from parents with regard to cost is, I can't believe I am paying the same ticket price for this experience. And by this experience, they mean like kids holed up in the dorms on campus or kids being totally remote or whatever it is. It doesn't seem to justify that $80,000 price tag, say, for a year.
It doesn't. Right. If you think about the three things we talked about before, you're missing out on much of the education and you're missing out on much of the kinship if you're in a Zoom room or on a compromised campus. And so I can't really figure out why anybody's writing $75,000 checks for this right now. I have some sympathy for the institutions that have not cut the tuition, because what are they supposed to do, right? I mean, they still have all of the costs essentially that they did before, plus some extra safety and security costs. And, you know, if they cut the budget to ribbons, which they would have to do if they cut tuition, they'd have to fire people. And then those places wouldn't be the places that we want to send our kids to anymore. And then we enter a sort of death spiral. So, you know, I think everybody's just sort of hoping against hope that things will have normalized by September, but it is not at all clear that the 19-year-olds will have their jabs by then.
All right. You just mentioned the colleges side in all this. And I think, again, from a parent's perspective, the thought is, well, colleges must be raking it in if they're charging us all this money. But you're saying if they cut tuition, it sort of rips their budgets to shreds. So I guess, you know, the obvious question is like, why? Why is it so expensive? Why must they charge this amount of money? And then on top of it, many of them, of course, fundraise from their alumni. Like, what is all of this paying for?
Well, mostly it's paying for people. 65, 70, 75% of the budgets of these places are salaries and health insurance and other benefits, right? And it's the professors who earn way more than average, as one might argue they should, given that they spend, you know, a minimum of 5 years after they get their bachelor's degrees training, right? They spend more time in school than doctors do. And so, you know, there's a reasonable expectation of compensation there. There are more administrators for every 1,000 undergraduates than there were a generation ago. This is in part, although not completely, because of regulation. But we get the regulations that we vote for at the ballot box, right? And so the people who complain about that, or, you know, the whiners on the Wall Street Journal editorial page, right? You know, I get that those folks don't want regulations that govern equality on the playing field, an equal number of scholarships for female athletes and male, equal access for people with disabilities, particularly people with mental health issues, you know, all of that, right? But like, if you want a really great career counseling center and you don't want your kid to be adrift, if you want a mental health center that does not require a 2-week wait for your first appointment, if you want someone to answer the phone when the laptop is broken at 11 o'clock at night, then you are paying for administrators. And if you complain about that, you're going to end up with an education that's provided much more on the cheap. And then you're going to complain about that too.
We didn't even talk about the new roadmap, which hopefully will lead people to read the book themselves. But let me ask you this one final question. When we have cocktail parties again, and people corner you at the cocktail party, and they say, Ron, just like tell me the one main thing I need to know, the most important thing on that roadmap, how would you respond other than, you know, read the book?
I think I would encourage people to ask better questions and have more of a sense of entitlement to information. What I'm trying to do here is raise an army, sort of. I don't mean to be oppositional, but we have the right to demand more information when we are being asked to pay over $300,000 for something. And I often feel like people know more about how the pricing systems work with their mobile phone plans than they do about the discounting levers that are being pulled behind the scenes by schools that are offering merit aid to their children on the basis of, you know, their grades and SAT scores and their leadership. And it pays, literally it pays, to be a much more informed consumer, slightly more skeptical, armed with a long list of questions that you should demand better answers to.
So people should ask better questions of colleges, not just to worry about where are we going to get in, but really to think about themselves as an active consumer, a kind of client of the college, and really get at that information.
Exactly, right? I mean, what exactly makes your institution $200,000 better than my flagship state university, right? Imagine at the elite end, right? And you're choosing between Stanford and Berkeley. Like, explain that to me, Stanford. You know, you don't just get to wave your arms around and say prestige, right? Or, you know, the same thing at a slightly lower level of selectivity for, you know, a kid in Indiana, right? Who gets into, you know, Denison over in Ohio and gets into IU in Bloomington. And Denison might discount, you know, from $300,000 to $200,000 with a nice merit aid package. But there too, they are asking for six figures more than you would pay in Bloomington. What exactly are they delivering in any silo of interest of yours, right? Is it better access to professors? Is it a career counseling office that is, you know, twice as good? If so, like, what's the data that proves that I'm getting more from my money here, right? Just like find the things that are most important to you, the aspects of the college experience that you are most worried about, you know, sort of getting your money's worth, and then ask a bunch of questions.
All right. Well, until we can all get back to cocktail parties with Ron Lieber, we can read his book. The title again is The Price You Pay for College, An Entirely New Roadmap for the Biggest Financial Decision Your Family Will Ever Make. Ron, thank you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
This year marks the 125th anniversary of the New York Times Book Review. And each week on the podcast, we're going to celebrate in our own little way with Tina Jordan, who is the deputy editor of the Book Review and who is writing a book about the anniversary. Tina, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
So let's just start off with a little bit of background. You are the desk's archival snoop. Let's say you're our personal historian.
Yes, I'm an archives fiend. If I could spend all my time just trolling in the archives, I would.
And even before we began thinking about what this anniversary would look like, I feel like you were just constantly going into the archives and digging up great things and then sending them around or printing them out. Just to give you an example of like Tina's mischievousness on this front, like one time she found headlines containing each person who worked at the Book Review and on our desk's name. So it was like, Kelly gets away with murder, and, you know, Williams, you know, sinks again, and that kind of thing, and sent them all out. But you also found a lot of really just amazing, interesting literary history. Just like, give us a sense.
I did. And, you know, one of the things that interested me the most, clearly, was all the literary history that predates the Book Review itself. Like, why did the Book Review start in 1896? What was the reasoning behind it? Well, the reasoning behind it was there was literally so much books coverage. It was overtaking certain sections of the paper. It was a way for them to corral everything book-related in one area.
Book authors were the celebrities, really, of the day. So they gobbled up a lot of coverage. And I want to talk about some of those great stories over the years, really going back to even the prehistory of the Book Review each week. One of the things that I especially love are the sort of, I think what you call them, like death watches.
Yes.
Explain.
You know, back when authors like Dickens, like Mark Twain, like Walt Whitman were ill or dying, like, this was big news. These people, you know, they were the Beyoncés of their day. And in a way in which we would definitely today consider invasive, the paper would report health updates every day. In the case of Walt Whitman, this went on for months. Whether he got out of bed, what he had to eat, what he didn't eat, you know, how long the doctor thought he had left. Literally, there would be a front page update on Whitman's condition every day.
All right. Well, I would love to sit by the deathbed of Walt Whitman. Let's do that next week, Tina.
Absolutely. I'll be here.
All right. Thanks so much. Michael J. Stephen is an associate professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, and he is the author of Breathtaking: The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. And he joins us from outside of Philadelphia. Michael, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Pamela. Thanks for having me on.
All right, let's start with a very basic question, which is, how did you come to write a book about lungs?
I'm an associate professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia and director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center. I do both clinical work as well as research. I'm a pulmonary and critical care doctor trained, so which means I am both a lung doctor as well as an intensive care unit doctor. I started my training about 20 years ago, and I saw that we don't talk a lot about the lungs. We don't talk enough about the crisis of the lungs, which has increased in the past 40 years. It's the one disease state that has increased 30%, whereas, you know, cardiovascular disease, neurological disease, cancer has all declined. And today, we're seeing that downstream effect. COVID, with 500,000 deaths we're approaching here, is merely a symptom that we haven't taken issues related to our breath seriously enough. And I want to get the word out that breath is medicine, and we need to take our atmosphere very much more seriously.
Why has lung disease increased 30%, even given the decline in smoking and those other factors you talked about?
So there's still 32 million smokers in America. The air quality in America has gotten worse the past 3 years. So the American Lung Association says, you know, about 45% of Americans are exposed to high levels of pollutants that they shouldn't be. That's up from 125 million or about 38% of the population 3 years ago. So we have seen the lung issues stabilize in the last 10 years, but still a lot of smokers out there, a lot more pollution, a lot more allergens, and these things have just added up, and it's led to a decline in lung health.
One of the things that you talk about in your book is that our lungs help explain our origins. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean about that? I mean, does that have to do with the origin of each individual life from when we go from being in utero to being born and our lungs go from breathing in amniotic fluid to breathing in air? Or do you mean our origin as a species?
Both. I would say both. And you're absolutely right, right? So our lungs are the last organ to kick in as babies. You know, when we're in utero, the lungs are completely not functioning, right? Mom is giving us all of our oxygen needs. And then at birth, they spring open and spring to life. And that is the beginning of life, is the beginning of our lungs. So the heart, the kidneys, the brain, the muscles are all working in utero. The lungs are not. on a evolutionary timescale. The lungs are also our youngest organ evolutionarily. So we came out of the oceans with, you know, we had hearts, we had a GI tract, we had neurological system, but we had no lungs, and that had to develop over tens of millions of years, but we were successfully able to do it. And that was the challenge of us getting onto land was, you know, we needed a method of locomotion, but we needed lungs. So lungs are our youngest evolutionary organ, and today they're our most threatened, and they're fragile in that respect. They're the one major organ in constant communication with the atmosphere, and I don't need to tell anybody that today.
I want to approach this from the micro level for a second. When a baby is born and they go from being a fetus breathing in amniotic fluid to a baby breathing in air, that process, I think, for most parents is just completely mind-boggling. How does that happen? And I think in particular, when there's a premature birth and the lungs aren't fully formed, it sort of also makes that process very mysterious. And I'm curious if it's a mystery for the medical profession or if we fully understand this.
That's a great question. And I love your word of mystery, Pamela, because there are mysteries in the world and there are problems in the world. And medicine, I believe, can help solve problems, but mysteries sort of remain unknown. And there's a ton of mystery about the lungs today. COVID is, you know, exposing that. As far as breathing, yes, that moment where the baby comes out, the one job is that the lungs need to wake up. Baby needs to take a huge deep breath, suck out all of that amniotic fluid that's sitting in there, and take a deep breath and turn a bright red because mom's oxygen is getting cut off. So it's a very fraught moment. And if it doesn't go well, then we see what can happen, brain damage. And that's why the field of OBGYN can be so harrowing. And that moment of life where a baby defines itself is so important. And if they do come out early, there is a substance in the lungs, surfactant, a soap-like protein that helps our very thin alveoli where gas exchange occurs stay open. And if there's not enough surfactant, those lungs will not open up and you'll have to either get external surfactant or you'll have to be put in on a breathing machine until that surfactant kicks in. We didn't figure this out. And the one doctor was a Harvard doctor, Dr. Mary Ellen Avery. And she basically broke this field wide open of surfactant. Early lungs are fragile lungs. And it's still a moment of miraculous birth. There's mystery there, but there's a lot more that we understand today.
When was that surfactant? When did that happen, that discovery?
That was 1958, 1959. A lot of that research came out of the Cold War. You know, the lungs were the place where toxins were going to be introduced from our enemies. So we sat down. A lot of this was government work, unlike a lot of scientific discoveries funded by the government. And Mary Ellen Avery put it together that this surfactant was deficient in these babies and that we need to replace it in these early preemies. And it cut the mortality by, you know, over 95%. And it's just incredible the amount of lives that this one person, this one amazing physician, the first head of a clinical department at Harvard Medical School, changed the world.
All right. You mentioned that there are other mysteries that we don't know, and we will get to COVID because obviously that is the probably biggest respiratory issue on most people's minds right now. But what are some of the other things that we really just still don't understand about how our lungs work?
I think you could pretty much pick any disease in pulmonary medicine. And that's the paradox. So we understand that there's beauty in the lungs, there's beauty in the breath. Biology sort of breaks the problems down to very small things and chops it up. And we haven't been able to connect those two. And I like sort of like the physics analogy. There's quantum mechanics, and then there's Einstein's theory of relativity, and those have not been joined. And in pulmonary medicine, the beauty of the lungs and the problems that are there have not been joined. And I try to join them in my book, and I think I'm as successful as one can be. But let's take one quick example, asthma. So asthma rates in 1980 in the United States were 3%, and now they're up over 8%. So what is going on with our atmosphere that is driving this huge increase in asthma? It's kind of an autoimmune disease, right? So is it the carbon dioxide? Is it the pollen? Is there some other pollutant in the air that's driving this huge increase in asthma? There's a lot of ideas. We don't know for sure. I take a deep, deep dive into it in my book, but it's slightly unsatisfying. And as I say, you know, there's this paradox between mysteries and problems. And we have a long way to go in pulmonary medicine, no question about it.
All right, you mentioned connections. You used that word a few times. How do you look at a single organ when they are all so interconnected? I mean, you mentioned cardiovascular medicine earlier. I mean, how do you sort of take this organ and look at it in isolation when it's so heavily involved in circulation, in the immune system, and all of the other components of the human body?
The short answer is you can't. But I think the best way to solve problems in biology is to create systems that are very small so you can isolate systems and try to answer very small questions. And then once you have that small question answered, you need to take it out to the bigger issue. You absolutely need to get the heart involved, the brain. The sum of the body is greater than the parts. And that's just sort of the philosophy of biology right now. We create these systems that are extremely complex. We try and solve problems at a small level and then see if it holds at the bigger level as well.
All right. I want to talk about another relationship, and that is between the lungs and breathing and mental health. You know, I think that when someone is upset or anxious or worried or scared, one of the first things that anyone will say is, you know, take a deep breath, calm down, breathe deeply. Why does deep breathing, meditation, calmness work? I mean, on a medical level, looking at the lungs, like, how do we understand this? What's our understanding of this?
The Buddha, you know, 2,500 years ago was onto this. The only path to nirvana is through the breath. And he states this, and it's absolutely true today. Our understanding today is through the parasympathetic nervous system. So that's our rest and digest mechanism. The biggest cranial nerve we have is the vagus nerve, and that innervates our diaphragm. And so when we're taking easy, slow, deep breaths with our diaphragm, we're inflating the bottom part of our lungs where most of the blood flow goes, and the body loves that. And this vagus nerve, which is through the diaphragm, sends signals back to our brain that all is well with the breath, all is well with carbon dioxide and oxygen, and the brain starts secreting these feel-good hormones of prolactin, of dopamine, of serotonin. So you can increase serotonin through deep breaths, through stimulating the diaphragm, through belly work, and that's the exact same hormone that we know through Prozac, that Prozac increases. So there's a direct relationship between feeling good, taking deep breaths, our body being in sync with our breath, and there's a clear hormonal basis to it.
When people exercise and they want to get in shape, we often talk about increasing your cardiovascular fitness. And I don't know if people just really understand the sort of physiology of this. I mean, can you build up your lungs the way you do with any muscle? Can you increase your lung capacity beyond what you're born with?
This is a very important point. So the short answer is there's two very important parts to breathing. There's your lung tissue itself. And the short answer is no, you cannot build back up lung tissue itself. You can avoid toxins. You can avoid cigarette smoke. You can avoid other pollutants that help destroy it. But there is nothing that you can do right now. Stem cells may change that in the future to increase lung function. What you can do, absolutely, though, is increase the what we call the pump function of the lungs. And that's the muscles of your chest and your diaphragm. And increasing those muscles and increasing that muscle strength can more than overcome any loss of lung function itself that happens with as a natural aging process. So this is taught in every COPD pulmonary rehab throughout the country. You got to strengthen the muscles of your chest. That will make you feel better and feel like you have more lung function, and you will get more out of life by strengthening those muscles and the diaphragm as well.
So how do you strengthen those muscles?
Weight work. You know, weight work is very important. Very simple things. Some people do breathing exercises. I do 3 minutes of breathing exercises to make sure my diaphragm is getting a workout every day. But it's fitness. It's working those muscles out, making sure that aging process of your muscles declining is not something that you have to tolerate.
Let's talk about one of the things that seems to me like a complete miracle of modern medicine. And I'm curious to hear sort of when we learned how to do lung transplants, how they work, how successful they are now, and double lung transplants in particular.
It's an incredible story. You know, the first successful kidney transplant was done in 1964, around there, and patient did very well. It took 20 more years almost to do a successful lung transplant. You know, 44 patients had attempts at lung transplant during that period, and it just took a lot longer. And today, we've come a long way with lung transplants. We do almost 3,000 in the country every year, from the first successful one in 1983 by Dr. Joel Cooper at the University of Toronto. But the outcomes are still not nearly as good as any other organ transplant. And by that, you know, heart, I'm talking about liver, and then kidney is the best. You know, the kidneys are nicely sequestered in the back of the belly. They don't have this constant connection with the atmosphere. And chronic rejection in lung medicine is from something in the air, and we're back to mysteries here. We have no idea what causes chronic lung rejection, which severely impedes outcomes in long-term lung transplant recipients. We're back to a mystery there.
All right. Well, the reason I asked that question is because a friend of mine is a double lung transplant. And so this brings us to COVID, because obviously this is not a good time for him. And he is, you know, very much, you know, being careful until he can get the vaccine. What have we learned about the lungs thus far from our understanding of the coronavirus?
We have learned a tremendous amount about the lungs and the coronavirus in just 8 months, but we have a long way to go. So we understand that the coronavirus goes to the bottom of our lungs. It can infect the lungs directly. It does not need to replicate in the nose first. One of these very strange things that we saw happening was called happy hypoxia. So these patients with very low oxygen, it didn't seem to affect them. And, you know, the reason is that this virus very much stays in the interstitium for a while. It doesn't create this increasing shortness of breath that we see. I will say that a lot of the lessons that we've learned about COVID have reinforced other lessons, and we've gotten back to basics with lung medicine in terms of we ventilate these patients on ventilators pretty much the same way. We intubate them at the same levels of illness as before. So we've learned a lot about the virus. We've learned about a lot about the lungs through this, but a lot of the lessons, you know, there was panic early, and we've gotten back to a lot of those old lessons that we learned in medicine about the lungs.
All right. I want to leave you with a question about one of your own questions, which is whether related to coronavirus or not, what is the sort of big, for you, most unanswered and interesting question around the lungs right now? If you could sort of figure one thing out with research, what would it be?
I want to focus on immunology of the lungs, very basic immunology of the lungs. I think we're going to need to answer questions about what our cells are doing in real time. There's hundreds of cells acting in constant motion coming in and out of the lungs. So I think we need to get back to the basic science of the lungs and what is happening with the interaction of our breath and our lungs. And if we understand that question better, that very basic question better, we are going to solve issues like coronavirus. We're going to solve issues like asthma, like pulmonary fibrosis. We need to just get a better understanding of what's happening between the cells of our lungs, which is extremely complex, and our atmosphere. That is the key to solving all of these problems.
All right. Well, for now, I'm just going to take a deep breath, but it sounds like at least it's a good start. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Pamela. It's been a pleasure.
Michael J. Stephen is the author of Breathtaking: The Power, Fragility, and Future of Our Extraordinary Lungs. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela.
How are things?
Things are good. We've gotten some new holiday sales figures where sales were up astronomically over 2019. This was from November. So this is another sign that even though there are major economic problems in the country right now and a big public health emergency, people are still flocking to books. So that is quite promising. So the Association of American Publishers released their November sales figures and showed that trade sales were up more than 30%. in November. That's partly because 2019 was a weird year because they were comparing those figures to Michelle Obama's November. And this past November, of course, we had Barack Obama's memoir, which really boosted print sales again. So it's funny that the year in between was way down because there was not an Obama book.
So what we're saying is, like, Sasha and Malia, get to work on your memoirs.
Absolutely.
Need an Obama memoir every fall.
Get on it. So we're continuing to see a lot of big books coming out this year. And I think publishers are hopeful that this will be another big year, too, that were just announced deal with the pandemic, which is obviously a massive story that is being covered daily by the news media, but is also something that nonfiction authors are digging into. So the two big announcements this week were one from Michael Lewis, who is coming out with a book called The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. It's due out in May, and I spoke to him about it a little bit. He was a little cagey because he wants, you know, some of the book to be a surprise, but essentially it follows a biochemist, a public health worker, and a federal government employee who worked in the White House as they sort of track the spread of the virus and try to raise alarms about what's happening when they feel like the response from the federal government is not adequate. It was interesting because, of course, his last book, The Fifth Risk, was really looking at, you know, what could happen if the government agencies that are tasked with managing catastrophes fell short, like the ones that are in charge of managing climate change and, you know, epidemics and things like that. So he told me that as soon as people started becoming aware that coronavirus was spreading in this country, he started calling up his sources from The Fifth Risk, and they were even more alarmed than people that were being quoted in the news because they felt like not only was this going to be a huge public health crisis, this was also kind of a dry run for an even worse pandemic. And the fact that we failed to kind of meet the challenge this time scared them a lot about what a real, even more deadly virus or pathogen could do. So that was a fun conversation. It actually was quite interesting, if disconcerting.
Yeah, it really brings me back to when he was on the podcast talking about The Fifth Risk. He really talked about exactly this, you know, that all of these departments of the government that keep things going that we don't often think about necessarily, like the Department of Agriculture, are in fact, you know, those departments that are really necessary during a crisis. So that's fascinating. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, I'm very excited to read it. And I think the point he made that was kind of optimistic was he described the book as a superhero story where the superheroes seem to lose the war, but really they've lost the battle and they're going to win the war. So he was saying if there's not a worse pandemic, it's because of these people that he's writing about. So he's the latest prominent author to kind of tackle this massive subject, but there's a bunch of other books that I'm excited about from prominent science writers, including our own Sherry Fink, who's been doing incredible reporting for the New York Times about the crisis and how hospitals are managing with it. So her book, Surge, is looking at the ethical, social, and scientific dimensions of the pandemic. There's also a book coming from Lawrence Wright, which is coming out in June. It's called The Plague Year, and Knopf is publishing it. They, of course, published his novel, which was about a global pandemic, and it was called The End of October, and really had bizarrely prescient and extremely similar plot points to then what we saw with the coronavirus pandemic. So an interesting nonfiction book into that fictional tale.
The big piece he did in The New Yorker presumably was either the spur to that or kind of a pre-excerpt.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think a lot of the reporting that was in that really long New Yorker piece is sort of a precursor to what he'll expand on in the book. But it was practically a book-length piece, so that explains why we'll be getting it so soon in June.
So tell us what we know about when these books will come out.
Michael Lewis is coming out in May, and Lawrence Wright is coming out in June. And also this year, there is a book from Andy Slavitt, who has been a really prominent commentator on coronavirus and is now an advisor to President Biden, a senior advisor to the COVID response team. And so his book is called Preventable, and that'll be coming out this year as well, pretty soon.
All right. Lots of books to look forward to. Alexandra, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now are critics Dwight Garner and Jennifer Salai. Hey, guys.
Good morning.
Hi, Pamela.
Dwight, let's start with you. You reviewed a book about Lucian Freud.
Yeah, it's a double-barreled biography of Lucian Freud, two big volumes from a British biographer named William Fever. And of course, Lucian Freud is the great realist painter, the portraitist, the grandson of Sigmund Freud. And he was kind of a devil, a mischievous man, a man who seduced hundreds, if not thousands, of women, painted most of them naked, in addition to his own daughters, had a massive gambling problem, loved to criticize and hit and kick people. A wild, wild life. Fever, the biographer, is an art critic and a gifted one for The Observer in London, or at least he was a critic for them. But his biographies, they are difficult to read. He has a weird style. He had a lot of access to Freud in the last years of his life, and he quotes Freud at such length on every possible subject that I found these biographies to be very hard going.
So this is in two volumes, and when did the first one come out?
You know, I don't know the exact date of the first one, but it was a couple of years ago, and the second volume's here now. You know, I'm a big fan of kind of entertaining misanthropes, at least on the page, and I thought I would love these books because Freud can be fun to read about, you know, if he angered you. For example, he was painting Jerry Hall, the model, who was, of course, Mick Jagger's wife at one point, and he was painting her in a portrait, and he hated people being late. So when she was late twice, only twice, he painted her right out of the portrait and put somebody else in. And he's just sort of like cruel and mean and weird. There are a lot of good bits in these biographies, but they're very sort of, they feel very jumbled and thrown together. And I say in my review that you feel like you could skip four or five pages anywhere and not really miss a whole lot.
Were these authorized biographies?
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't come out and say that, but Freud talked to him for 30 years on the phone, and Freud knew he was writing something. And I wouldn't say they became really close, but the biographer Fever clearly is in the studio with him sometimes, and they talk to the phone almost every day.
I'm really interested in both Freud and biography. And one of the questions I had, and it was interesting reading your review, Dwight, was this issue of what a biographer chooses to put in and how smooth they decide to make the narrative and how much they decide to leave out. And it sounds like Fever is really one of those putter-inners, which I can kind of understand in the sense that, you know, clearly he's writing the authoritative biography of this figure, and he probably doesn't know necessarily what will and won't be of interest to people, you know, 50 years from now. But it sounds like it was not entirely readable. Is that the case?
Yeah, it is the case. You reviewed recently the memoir by Celia Paul. That's her name. Don't I have that right? He was in a relationship with Freud and was painted by him frequently, was a subject of Freud's. And one thing this book kind of tiptoes around but doesn't really get into is how all these women, he relentlessly hunted down women to paint and ended up sleeping with most of them, having relationships with most of them. And the book kind of tips around the politics of all this. And I'm curious to know, I read your review, but I didn't read Celia Paul's book. I read an excerpt of it somewhere, but how did she feel about her time with Freud?
It was fascinating to read about their relationship because she's very clear-eyed on how manipulative he could be. You know, at the beginning of their relationship, he was considerably older than she was. They met when she was, I think she might have still been, she might have been like 18 or 19.
I mean, I think she was a friend of Freud's daughters, I believe, or if she wasn't, she was the same age anyway.
Yes, she was the same age. She was an art student at the Slade, and he was a lecturer there 1 year, and that's how they met. And he would basically keep her waiting for him to show up at her flat, for him to call her because he wouldn't give her his phone number. And, you know, they had a decade-long relationship, I believe, and they had a child together, you know, one of his many children with different women. And in her memoir, she's very clear about the kind of person he was. And when she describes the beginning of the relationship, it sounds actually quite unpleasant. But then at the same time, she also shows how she grew to love him and that they actually did have a real connection. And so it's actually a pretty complicated book in that sense, in the way that the politics of it, you know, she doesn't really address it. But I think reading it now, especially, you know, lots of questions are raised.
Yeah, that's the sense I got. It was very complicated. And few of them seem to have a great deal of anger at him. One of them I know went outside to his car and I think wrote the word fart on the back of his car in paint one night at a restaurant. And he wasn't happy about that. But there aren't a lot of stories like that in the book.
All you have to do is mention the word fart on this podcast and you get a bunch of people laughing. Go on. Sorry.
You know, as you mentioned, Dwight, I mean, there were so many women and presumably Fever couldn't include all of them in even this two-volume biography that, you know, I'm sure that some of them would have maybe different things to say about him because he could be monstrous. I mean, I think that was also something that was known in his circle. But then at the same time, as you do say, you know, there were plenty of women who were very drawn to him, you know, and he kept sort of interesting connections with all his, or with the children that he at least acknowledged as his own, where emotionally he could be kind of distant, but at the same time, he was always willing to help in terms of money with his gambling or painting earnings.
I mean, he did have a, I wouldn't say a soft side, but his kids could touch him for money, and that doesn't sound right, does it? hit him up for money. We used to be able to say touch him up for money. But I recall reading recently a biography of Fellini, and there was these great stories about how women would literally fall out of trees into his car, into his convertibles as he drove down the streets. They wanted
in
his movies. No, I'm not joking. This is actually not a biography. It's in.
They just tumbled out of the trees like ripe
the
pieces
trees.
Of fruit.
Eugene Walters, he was one of the Paris Review founders, has a memoir in which he describes working with Fellini, and he has the story in there that he'd be stopped at a light, or maybe outside of his own house parking, and a woman would fall out of the tree into his front seat. But I imagine something similar with Lucian Freud. I mean, it's just, you know, he chased women, but women chased him as well.
Right, right.
I want to continue to, like, question that anecdote. Sorry, but...
I'll dig it up and bring it next time.
Yeah, let's call the fact checker on that. I want to ask you about another book that you reviewed recently, Dwight. You know, people in publishing, they talk, when they look at reviews from their own perspective, they talk about good reviews and negative reviews and positive reviews and the selling review. And you often write, like, for me as a reader, what is the selling review? Where I read a book that you review and I had no interest in it before I read your review, and then I'm immediately think I must get this book. And you reviewed recently one such book, The Liar's Dictionary by Ellie Williams, which it's a delightful review. So I urge listeners to go in and Google this up. But tell us about that book.
Well, she's a British writer and she's kind of a word geek. You know, she's a geeky word person who has written, she had a previous book of stories called Attrib, A-T-T-R-I-B period, as an attribution. And now she's got this novel, The Liar's Dictionary, and it's about people who compile dictionaries, and it's about a sort of failed dictionary, one that lives in the shadow of more famous dictionaries, and it famously was never completed, and it goes back and forth in time from some of it set today, some of it set about 120 years ago. It's a comic novel. It's word besotted, I would say. My review, I did praise it quite a bit, but I also said at the end, there's something about it. Some word things can be too cute. It's like you walk into a bookstore and see something, you know, etched onto a bookmark or something. Sometimes it's just a little bit too cute. And her book can converge into the cute once in a while. But I like it. She's a good writer, and I think she'll be doing more good stuff.
Yeah, I feel like your description, you know, people probably very neatly fall into, that sounds so amazing, and that sounds incredibly dull.
As I say, I mean, it's like if you buy like Benjamin Dreyer's book, if you love that book about just about modern usage, and you're just a word geek and love dictionaries and other kinds of reference books, this is definitely a novel you should check out.
All right, count me in. Jen, you wrote about a word, actually, in an essay recently. Tell us about that word.
Yes. So, you know, it's funny because I feel like by the time this podcast appears, it might feel a little bit like ancient history, but the essay was about the word Orwellian, and it was occasioned by the events of, I want to say like 47 years ago, but really it was only 2 weeks ago, which was when a mob stormed the Capitol, and Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who was one of the people who could arguably be said to have helped encourage this mob by saying that there was perhaps problems with the election, his book contract was canceled. And so he took to Twitter, as one does nowadays, to
say...
when they're unhappy, and to say that this was... nothing could be more Orwellian, I think was the way that he phrased it. That essentially this was an act of censorship on the part of the publisher. Shortly thereafter, sales of 1984 shot to the top of Amazon's bestseller list. And so I wanted to look at the term Orwellian and how it's been used and perhaps abused over the years, and also to look at, you know, the question of whether there is in fact much of a connection to what's actually in the text of 1984. And, you know, it was interesting to go back to the history of the word, because even though George Orwell was an incredibly prolific writer and wrote, you know, a number of books, thousands of reviews, columns, etc., He was perhaps best known for his two dystopian novels, Animal Farm and 1984. And to look at the way that his name has sort of come to be synonymous with everything that he seemed to hate was actually also interesting to think about. And the word Orwellian actually has been used by people across the political spectrum to mean very different things. And I think part of the reason is that if you think about it, like we live in a time that's incredibly divided in terms of politics in the US. But I think the reason why people resort to that word is because people on all sides of the political spectrum can agree that the world that's depicted in 1984 is something that nobody wants. And so the word itself has become weaponized in that way. And so what you have now is that you have people on the right who use it to describe what would maybe loosely be described as cancel culture, the idea that certain positions, certain views are not allowed in the public discourse. Whereas if you actually look at the book itself, it has less to do with this idea of absolute free speech and much more to do with brutality, totalitarianism, you know, even the idea that truth has been manipulated. I mean, that's a huge part of the novel. And so the essay was really just trying to explore those different ideas.
I feel like there was a missed opportunity for humor somewhere in here to be like, no, the book he meant was Keep the Apodistra Flying. You know, this had nothing to do with 1984.
Exactly. That's what Orwellian should mean.
I think, and you referenced this essay in your piece, the more appropriate or apt thing to read by Orwell on this subject probably is Politics in the English Language, particularly in this case, because it's so much about how you can manipulate words or phrases to mean essentially the opposite of what they're intended to mean.
Right, exactly. And also in that essay, he talks about metaphors that are dead or dying, those words that have essentially become ways for us to stop thinking to a certain extent. And I feel like Orwellian has ironically become one of those words that people just sort of reach for it. They may not have even read the book 1984.
Oh, Jen, many of them probably have not read it.
Right. Or maybe they last read it in high school when, you know, it's sort of assigned to reading lists and maybe some of the more complicated notions that are suggested in the book are actually not really dealt with. And so it is an irony that I was wondering also when I was writing it, I was thinking, you know, Orwell was somebody who was always alert to ironies, because I think this sort of discrepancy between reality and tension, that was something that he was always writing about. And I do wonder what he would have made of a world where his own name has become a way for people to stop thinking, essentially, a word that some people just reach for and use it to make a political point.
I don't think that Animal Farm and 1984 are such givens on the junior high school or middle school, should we say, curriculum or high school curriculum anymore. I mean, I have such memories, you know, in 1984, if you were in school in 1984, you were assigned 1984 to read. It was just a given. And now, I don't know. Dwight, were your kids assigned to read either book in school?
Yeah, I think they read both. And, you know, it's funny, both of them were on Broadway not so long ago, or one of them was. I remember taking my kids to those. But, you know, I said to my kids, I'm like, you guys, this is the wrong Orwell. I mean, you know, the Orwell you want to read are all those great newspaper columns he wrote in the essays. And matter of fact, I think of George Orwell every single morning because one of my favorite pieces he wrote is called A Nice Cup of Tea. And I think he wrote it in 1946, just about how you make a cup of tea. And he has 11 tips. And it's the most charming essay in the world. And I take his tips. I use them. This was written before sort of the tea bag debased the whole ritual of making tea. He used loose leaves, you know. But you bring the cup to the boiling water, not the other way around, because the water has to still be boiling as you pour it into the cup. And then I think it's important that, I'm trying to think what else, that the milk be, or no sugar is one of the crucial things he says. He thinks if you put sugar in your tea, you're not actually tasting it. So anyway, I think of George.
Does he add the milk first or the tea first? Does he add the tea to the milk or the milk to the tea?
You know, I was about to say something about that. Then I realized I don't remember. And I think about this essay all the time. I'm not sure the milk comes up, but it must come up. Oh, I'm very angry at myself for not having this at the tip of my tongue. But I recommend, it's online, I believe, A Nice Cup of Tea by Orwell.
Well, here's my Orwell recommendation. It's not about tea. It's about Peeing, but one of my favorite essays. Yeah, it's just the opening. And I want to read it because maybe it'll bring in some readers to Orwell who might not have thought that they were naturally Orwell readers. But this is from his essay, Such Were the Joys. Have both of you read this?
Yeah, but it's been a while.
Yeah.
He starts off, soon after I arrived at St. Cyprian's, not immediately, but after a week or two, just when I seemed to be settling into the routine of school life, I began wetting my bed. I was now aged 8, so this was a reversion to a habit which I must have grown out of at least 4 years earlier. Nowadays, I believe bedwetting in such circumstances is taken for granted. It is a normal reaction in children who have been removed from their homes to a strange place. In those days, however, it was looked on as a disgusting crime which the child committed on purpose and for which the proper cure was a beating. For my part, I did not need to be told it was a crime. Night after night, I prayed with a fervor never previously attained in my prayers. Please, God, do not let me wet my bed. Oh, please, God, do not let me wet my bed. But it made remarkably little difference. Some nights the thing happened, others not. There was no volition about it, no consciousness. You did not properly speaking do the deed. You merely woke up in the morning and found that the sheets were wringing wet. That was long, but
that's
I
so
hope
good.
Worth it. It's so good.
Absolutely
right?
worth it. I think each one of us should read something
it's
like that every
so
week.
Good.
I enjoyed that. Thank you. We moved from flatulence to urine in the course of only 15
that's
minutes.
That's right. We've gone
that's
full circle. Dwight, Jen, always a pleasure. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.